This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So only disclosure, as Mike said, one of the co-PIs, national PIs, along with Alec Farber and Kenny Rosenfield. I think everyone is aware of the natural history of CLI and the tremendous impact it has with regard to amputation and mortality and the burden it poses to our society. I'm sure you're all aware also of the absolute explosion of endovascular therapy over the last couple of decades. This shows no signs of abating. This is Phil Goodney's update to that slide, previous slide, which we've all seen. The trends continue. Probably the only change in the trends of note is, for the first time, signs that the amputation rates are once again starting to go up after years of going down. So the literature is now populated with studies such as this. Endovascular first seems to be the way to go, and there's been a dramatic change in the kind of way that many vascular surgeons and vascular specialists in general approach critical limb ischemia. This is all in the backdrop of exploding cost. And this is the REACH registry, and it basically explains the tremendous amount of resources that we devote to CLI. Last year, the U.S. government expended over $4 billion for CLI treatment alone. So it's 2016. We have different options for critical limb ischemia. We can use medical therapy. It's not particularly effective. It's vital, obviously, as a background improvement in overall medical care. We do primary amputation when the situation warrants it, and we do more and more hybrid procedures. However, often it does come down to remaining a decision between open surgery or endovascular therapy. And the question of which is best is one that I've sort of struggled with my own practice and many of my colleagues around the country. When one looks at what the current state of evidence is, I'm sort of drawn to this paper by Sean Tunis. Sean Tunis was an internist at the time. This is a paper he wrote in the New England Journal 25 years ago. And ironically, he struggled with the exact same thing that we continue to struggle with today, the use of angioplasty, surgery, and how they relate to both resources and amputation. He went on to become the director of CMS, and I would pose that we have not moved the bar forward. He did not really come up with a definitive solution, and one continues to elude us. The limitations of the current data are rampant, and the endpoints, we talked a little bit about target vessel, target lesion revascularization yesterday, but the endpoints of the data that's there really fall short. All sorts of sponsor bias, operator bias, mixing of the data sets between claudicants and CLI, and poor follow-up. A lot of reports such as this is one-year data on SFA endovascular interventions. We certainly live in the world of drug elution, and it has really moved the bar forward, and the results clearly are improved, again, as we heard about yesterday, and we'll hear about likely more today. However, anyone who's been around a couple of years knows that sometimes what's promised does not always pan out, and I think the jury is still out on the true role, particularly as finances become more and more part of the picture. So in vascular surgery, anyway, if one looks closely at where we've gone with carotid disease and aortic disease, our efforts at really coming up with good level one data has been pretty good, lots and lots of trials to point to. With CLI, on the other hand, we certainly have the PREVENT 3 database, now over 10 years old, and apart from that, all we have really is BASIL. BASIL was a laudable effort. It was undertaken in England. It also was more than 10 years old and had some severe flaws. In my mind, the most prominent flaw was that endovascular therapy is limited to angioplasty alone. And so by the time the trial was finished, most of us here in North America did not practice with angioplasty alone. And so the application of this trial to our daily practice was somewhat limited. About, I guess, last summer, last June, CMS put together a MedCAC meeting on PAD. At that meeting were Skylar Jones and Manish Patel from Duke, and they were charged with looking at the data available today and summarizing its utility in helping us wrestle with this question. And it probably won't surprise you that their conclusion is, over and over and over again, as they went through each and every study, there's a paucity of high-quality data available to help us with this decision that we're trying to make. And so we continue to really be on unsure footing. Phil Goodney's done some great work, many publications similar to this, looking at what's going on across the country in various Medicare and large data sets. And this is just one snapshot of the variation in the country with regard to amputation rates. And it's tremendous variation that's somewhat shocking. Similarly, variation in lower extremity revascularization and the amount of different sites look to and undertake angiographic and revascularization efforts prior to amputation. So all of this leads to this slide, which is also somewhat remarkable. This is a slide from the VQI, courtesy of Jack Cronenwed, and it's all the centers that are currently in the VQI, which has almost 30% cardiology centers, not just vascular surgeons, in the U.S. and Canada. And on the left, you have sites that do nothing but bypass, and on the other end of the spectrum, sites that do nothing but surgery and everything in between. So if you had to get some measure of equipoise across the country in terms of how CLI should best be treated, you can't get a better example than this slide. So this is sort of my depiction of where we stand with CLI treatment. Lots being done, not a whole lot of evidence on which to base it on. So out of this desire to improve this situation, we concocted the idea of the best CLI trial. Our goal at the outset was to design a trial that would have the impact of something like NASIT or ACAS or the Berry trial. As a quick overview, it's a prospective randomized multicenter open label superiority trial. It calls for 2,100 patients at 140 clinical sites in the US and Canada. It was generously funded by the NHLBI. And simply put, its goal is to assess outcomes, but also quality of life and cost in patients who are candidates for both open and endovascular therapy. It has a two-cohort design. The biggest cohort are those with best single-segment saphenous vein, and the second cohort are those with disadvantaged conduit. Why is it important? Well, we believe it's going to be positioned to answer questions of basal, a growing number of large and valuable registries, and a whole slew of non-randomized controlled data sets cannot answer. It's a pragmatic trial that has limitations, but we felt it was important to design it as such. We've made a large effort to make it multidisciplinary, and everyone that treats CLI in the U.S. and Canada has been invited to participate. Again, a two-cohort design. And novel primary and secondary endpoints. A lot of effort went into trying to determine what is the exact best endpoint for this particular trial. Again, lots of discussion. Male adverse limb event free survival was what we decided in the end. We have a number of key secondary endpoints that we're also well powered for. Reintervention and amputation free survival will capture all minor and major reinterventions. The gold standard historically of amputation free survival will also be well powered, and male POD. In an effort to address what we felt were shortfalls in existing data sets, we tried to come up with some novel endpoints that looked at the hemodynamic impact and the overall clinical impact of the different investigations under study. So just a closer look at what cost-effectiveness means and how it relates to the best trial. This is a typical trial, compares one intervention to a control. We do not have such a structure. We have two interventions, both of which are gold standard and practice all the time, open and endovascular intervention. Any cost-effective study adds the monetary input to their trial. And what we're doing is one step beyond that. We're using the data that we collect during the course of the trial and using a Markov analysis to predict the cost and the clinical outcomes of every patient in the trial over their projected theoretical lifetime. We're going to, of course, get good quality of life adjusted data. And again, with all of this, hopefully be able to make a real comment about what all this means to the patient. That is certainly an increasing interest of CMS and the government, and an important part of any trial such as this. This is a geographic map. We've got a good geographic distribution. We have a good mix of both private practice, academic centers, and everything in between. And again, we have a good multidisciplinary representation. Most of CLI in the U.S. and Canada is treated by vascular surgery, and so it is more weighted towards that, but a good number of cardiologists and radiologists as well. Current status, we began enrolling in August 2014. We have 121 sites open for enrollment, and currently just over the quarter mark with 538 patients randomized. Our predictions of the two cohorts is being matched relatively closely in terms of the breakdown. This is our enrollment curve. Obviously, our targets are challenging. We've done quite well to date. As we're into the steep part of the curve, it is an ongoing challenge. Certainly thank anyone and everyone who's a part of the trial for all their efforts to have us meet our targets. So just in conclusion, it's a unique trial we hope is positioned to assess the role of both endovascular and open surgery in different settings, when optimal conduit is present, when optimal conduit is not present, across a whole range of demographic variables that we're all interested in and impact our decision on a day-to-day basis in the office. We also hope to prospectively validate the SVS Wi-Fi classification, a very big step forward in terms of our ability to quantify wounds over and above just the Rutherford scale and the OPG endpoints that are the backbone of our own trial endpoints. So in sum, hopefully define an evidence-based standard of care. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.